And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. So we've got a good show for you today. I've always been interested in fungi and mushrooms, and I've always been amazed at the less known aspects of its ecology that continue to sort of emerge in popular culture, but obviously on the cutting edge of science and research about the way that mushrooms interact in the forest ecosystem and the way they interact with plants and so on. So I found this pretty good talk by Kat Sweeney from the Bell Museum at the University of Minnesota. And the Bell Museum is Minnesota's official natural history museum. Kat Sweeney is in the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Minnesota. So Kat Sweeney is given a proper introduction here by the host, Leah Peterson. So here is that introduction and an excerpt of Kat Sweeney's lecture about fungi and their ecology.
All right, our speaker is Kat Sweeney, and I met her this summer because in the summers I occasionally teach summer camps at the Bell Museum for kiddos, and we had a fourth through sixth grade camp, and I think we were doing the sustainability camp, yep. And Kat came in to work with our kids planting oyster mushrooms. So we planted oyster mushrooms in like a straw medium, and it was very cool. Those are edible, of course. But also talked a little bit about applications of mushrooms to possible biofuels in the future. So that was a tie into sustainability. And I just thought Kat did an amazing job with the kids. And so that very day I was like, when can we get you in for Kat in cafe? So here she is. She was born and raised in Germany and moved to Minnesota in 1998. She's Associate of Science in Registered Nursing in the state of Minnesota, and worked as a registered nurse in Minnesota from 2002 to 2008. She has her BS from University of Minnesota in Biology, her MS from Oregon State University Plant Pathology with a focus on mycology. She is a lecturer in biology and botany at Framingham State University in Massachusetts, and then returned to Minnesota just about a year ago to be in her PhD project in the Department of Plant Pathology. She focuses on wood decaying fungi, so she's gonna be talking about that tonight. In her lab, she's worked with lichens and unique lichen compounds, several fungal pathogens of forest trees, the identification of fleshy mushrooms, microscopy of fungal tissues, and she loves outreach and teaching, has volunteered her time with the Bell, as I just mentioned, Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center, the Unity Center with Roseville Area Schools, and the Mycology Society of Minnesota. She also enjoys hiking, canoeing in the Boundary Waters, gardening, and cooking. All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction. I'm Kat, and I'm going to get us started tonight. I'm going to give a general overview of the fungi, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about what I actually do in the lab. Mushrooms and fungi, and as you'll notice, I tend to use the term interchangeably, are actually a really unique group of organisms. They are grouped in their own kingdom. So biologists recognize six kingdoms. So we have the archaeans or archaebacteria, the true bacteria, eubacteria, protist, plants, animal, and fungi. So again, fungi have very unique characteristics, and therefore they're grouped within their own kingdom by biologists. We can see some relatedness between all these organisms. And this relatedness was determined by researchers after doing some molecular analyses, extracting DNA from different organisms, comparing these to one another. And it was actually found out that fungi are more closely related to animals than they are related to plants. And that's pretty funny if you think about it. I think it was until about the 1960s, that fungi were grouped within the study of botany, right? So people believed that, okay, mycology is just a subtopic of botany. But as we know now, the fungi are actually more closely related to animals than they are related to plants. To give you an idea what's actually included in the kingdom fungi, we recognize five subcategories, if you will, five categories. And to give you an idea what is known within these categories, there's a group called the Chytridiomycota, the chytrids, on top here. And so far we know around 1,000 species there. And these are fungi that are usually associated with aquatic systems. The next up, we have a group that's called the Zygomycota. Also, around 1,000 species are known here. If you are interested in fungi, you may know that this group is currently in flux, meaning that taxonomy is a bit open at this time, and biologists are trying to reorganize the specimens within this group. So around 1,000 known species within the Zygomycota. Then we have the Glomeromycota. Again, around 1,000 species are known of these, and these include the fungi that are associated with plants. So many of these live in close association with plants. Then at the bottom here, we have two large groups, the Ascomycota with around 65,000 known species, and the Basidiomycota with 30,000 known species. And I guess people tend to know these things a little bit better. So those fleshy fungi you see in the forest are included there. Many of those pathogens that you may know, fungal pathogens, are included in there. And so they make up the largest portion of the fungi that are known and described today. So this British researcher, Harksworth, in the 90s actually has released an estimate of what is believed to be the biodiversity of fungi that's out there. And that estimate came out to be around 1.5 million species, right? So now if you look at what's known and described so far, you realize, well, this is a really understudied group of organisms, right? We probably only know 5% of the fungi that are out there. So really not a whole lot, right? So yeah, biologists tend to focus on other things, I guess you could say, not so much on the fungi, so an understudied group of organisms. So this was in the 90s, right? But if you look at actually some current numbers, the estimate, a more current estimate for the fungal biodiversity that's out there is believed to be around 5 million species. So if you put that in perspective, right, as mycologists, we really don't know anything yet, it seems like. So there is a lot left to be discovered. And also, if you feel like in your lifetime you'd like to describe a new species, you may want to give mycology a try, right? And check it out. You might be able to describe something new. So taking just a quick look at the fossil record of fungi, I guess you can say there isn't a very big fossil record for the fungi. But from what is there, it has been extrapolated that in evolutionary time, fungi go back to around 460 million years. So they originated around 460 million years ago. That's interesting because looking at plants and the plant fossil record, it was determined that plants go back around 470 million years ago. So a couple hundred million years in between there, and evolutionary time that really isn't all that much. And that really made researchers start to look in a connection here, you know? So a connection between the first origin of plants and fungi in evolutionary time. And if you think about it, so initially all organismal life on the planet was suspended in the water, right? All old organisms were aquatic. And so somehow the plants and the fungi must have evolved together in order to get up onto dry land. And so the scientists today believe that plants and fungi may have done that in close association, namely in a symbiosis. So a symbiosis meaning a close living arrangement between two or more organisms, two or more parties, that often happen to live in mutualism, so both partners or all partners benefiting each other. So that's the current idea here, that fungi and plants actually conquered dry land together symbiotically. And what those old plants could have looked like, the early plants, really were just something low to the ground. Okay, so the fungal body. What makes fungi so unique? Why do they have their own kingdom? Why are they so different from anything else? If you remember sitting in biology class, right, you may remember, okay, a teacher will talk about an animal cell. It's kind of a blob-shaped, roundish thing. You may think about a plant cell is kind of a square-shaped thing, you know. But then you look at the fungal cell, which is called a hypha, plural hyphae. So it really is just an elongated tube with a whole lot of cytoplasm in it and organelles that swim around in it, right? So this is our fungal cell. One fungal cell, it's a hypha. So you have aggregates or clusters of hyphae, right? And together, a cluster of hyphae makes a mycelium. Actually, if anybody in the room here plays Scrabble, get your notepad out. These are some really high-scoring words. So like, they go all the fungal, the terms for morphology scores pretty high. So just a heads up. Okay, so and then depending on what fungal species we're looking at, sometimes you get these dense clusters of hyphae, so something, a mycelial mat, a hyphal mat that you often see. So that's essentially the fungal body. Okay, so for the most part of the year, the fungus, the mushroom, or the fungus rather, I should say, will exist in this form, right, in just kind of a mycelial mat. Right, but when the environmental conditions are right, the mycelium will actually produce what we know as a mushroom, right? Which is essentially the fruiting body that is produced with the intent to have a structure that will make spores for reproduction. So when you see the mushroom, it's just really an extension of the mycelium that is there for most of the year. And usually, as you walk around outside, you don't really pay attention to a mycelium, right? Sometimes it's really hard to see. It's covered up with leaf litter or what have you, right? But once the mushroom is there, you actually know that there is actually something going on, that you have this transient structure there. You know, you walk in the forest one weekend and you have a mushroom. Next weekend, it might be already gone to mush, right? So these are very transient, don't stay very long. But these are the reproductive structure of the fungus, the spore-producing entity that doesn't stick around for very long. Okay, so if you think about how does a fungus survive? How does it get its food? What does it do to make a living? We can generalize and say that there are three types of fungal lifestyles, okay? So fungi, like I mentioned before, can live in symbiosis. Symbiosis, so a close living arrangement. And that often tends to be a type of mutualism where both, or I should say all partners, could be more than two, in that symbiosis will benefit, right? So with the fungi, it will often be a situation where the fungus shares the food with the organism that it lives with symbiotically. Then next up, we have the saprophytic lifestyle. Fungi can be saprobes, so they can be live saprophytically, which means that they essentially grow in their food. They grow in a substrate that they can decompose or degrade, and via degradation, they can actually extract their food, their nutrients, out of the degraded matter. Then finally, we have fungi that get their nutrients through parasitism, right? So fungi that parasitize other fungi, that parasitize animals or plants or what have you. And I'm going to give you a few examples up next of what these three types of fungal lifestyle might look like. So a type of mutualistic symbiosis between a fungus and a plant is called a mycorrhizae. That's 65 points. So mycorrhizae refers to the fungi that colonize the roots, the root system of a plant, okay? In fact, and this is crazy when you think about it, it is estimated that about 90% of all vascular plants live in symbiosis with fungi. 90%, that's nuts. Right? So that's a ton. That's a ton. So really, really important really important for the ecosystem. So if we take this apart, right, and we look at the two partners, so fungus and plant in the symbiosis, who's doing what, you can say that the fungus in this relationship, also called the mycobiont, is actually helping the plant to take up extra nutrients, such as nitrogen and phosphorus, and also helps it to get some extra water. The plant, or the plant partner, also called photobiont, photo as in photosynthesis, right, provides the glucose or the sugars to the mushroom. So again, the plant gives the fungus sugars, and the fungus gives the plants additional access to nutrients and additional water resources. So everyone's happy. It's a good deal. And normally you have on the roots these little root hairs, little structures that help the plant to absorb water. And nutrients in this example, actually the scientist was looking at phosphate uptake by roots. So if you follow the dotted line here, okay, you can see that the root by itself, even with its little extension, the root hairs, it can only reach so far, right? And it can only get the nutrients that are really close to it, where it grows. And we actually call this the depletion zone, right? So this area is where the plant gets its nutrients from. Now, if you compare this to a situation where a root is colonized with a mycorrhizal fungus, and you can see that through the mycorrhizal associate, the plant is actually able to reach beyond the depletion zone and to get more nutrients out of the soil, right? So definitely a big plus for plant growth, for plant development, to have these mycorrhizal partners. What this brought to mind for me was this cool plant, related species. When I lived out in Oregon, I've actually seen those out there. This orchid is called Corallorhiza maculata, and it belongs to a group of plants that are considered to be the achlorophyllous plants, meaning that they do not have any chlorophyll and therefore barely undergo photosynthesis, right? So how does this plant get any nutrients? So you can say that it pretty much entirely depends on its mycorrhizal associate. So this is really cool. So this plant has actually figured out to survive pretty much without photosynthesis, just with the help of a mycorrhizal associate. So a pretty cool situation. So let's take a look at a different fungal lifestyle. Parasitism. So there are many, many fungal parasites out there that will cause plant diseases. And this one infects animals, particularly amphibians. And this has gotten some press. Perhaps some of you have heard about this before. Let me see if I can pronounce it. Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis. This one causes amphibian decline. So it has actually put a few frog species on the endangered species list in North America, but this is something that has been around the globe. So this is killing amphibians everywhere. So if you look at the close-up here at the histology slide, you can see here the spore masses that tend to grow in the outer layers of the skin in amphibians, in the frogs here in this example. And by proliferating in the outer layer of the skin, it will actually impair gas exchange in these animals, and then ultimately they're going to die as they are not able to oxygenate sufficiently. So this is a big problem for amphibians worldwide. Then another fungal parasite that is fairly new, I shouldn't say newly described, but newly recognized within the last 10 years or so. This one is called Pseudogymnoascus destructens. Perhaps you've heard about this before by the disease that it causes in bats, white mouse syndrome. Also, this fungus was recently renamed. Formerly, it was Geomyces destructens. So this is a cause of white mouse syndrome in bats. So bats, when they hibernate, they get infected
with this fungal parasite, and it tends to grow in the nasal cavity of bats, in the oral cavities, and it actually it's a quick killer for these animals. It's a bit unique for the fungi in that it likes the colder temperatures, so those that you could find in a place where bats would hang out to hibernate in a cave, right? So 5 to 14 degrees Celsius. It has been shown that there's animal-to-animal transmission of this pathogen, which, of course, is a problem. And then it has also been shown that certain debris that accumulates in a cave or also bat feces that is a source of inoculum and that can spread the disease. So, again, it's a big problem. In North America, it has put a few species of bats on the endangered species list. So a big problem. I guess one thing I can do is, I guess, public service announcement. I don't know how many of you guys go actively caving. But I guess one thing people can do is try to stay out of caves if you know that bats are hibernating in there. If you take gear into a cave, be sure to really thoroughly clean that when you're done. Or better yet, don't transport it from one cave to another cave. Yeah, so white nose syndrome, a big problems with bats in North America. Interestingly, this pathogen exists all over Europe. It has been isolated from the nasal cavity, respiratory cavity in bats in Europe. It does not kill European bats. It's a killer for North American animals, or North American bats, I should say. So there is some research that focuses on that these days. So hopefully we can get a little bit better an understanding here soon. One more parasite. The group of fungi in the genus Melassezia, well-known by veterinarians, so they cause a lot of issues on pets, skin issues on dogs, cats. Sometimes you can see that also on goats and sheep. So vets see this one a lot around here. So there's all kinds of other fungal diseases on humans, but I don't have the time to go through all of these, so that will be another cafe. Okay, so lastly, the third group of fungal lifestyles, okay, would be fungi acting as decomposers. Okay, so think about it. Fungus grows on dead organic matter and is able to degrade that, is able to decompose that, right? So if you think about it, the fungal decomposers are actually a way to clean up, they have a way to clean up the ecosystem, right? Think about a tree falls in the forest, fungus goes on top of it, degrades it, feeds itself, and in the process, frees up nutrients out of that complex woody structure that are then made available for the rest of the ecosystem. So fungi can decompose organic matter. And I put a little diagram here, and perhaps it's difficult to make out the details. Let me give you the takeaway point here. If we start with a green arrow, green as in photosynthesis, right? You can see that photosynthesis in plants takes in atmospheric carbon dioxide, makes glucose, right? Makes from glucose, we get more complex organic compounds, okay? As these organic compounds eventually die then and are degraded by fungi, the fungi will break down these compounds eventually all the way down back to CO2 and return the CO2 back to the atmosphere. So you can see that fungi and their decomposer activity, their degrading activity, are really important for the ecosystem and proper ecosystem functioning. So fungi can degrade all kinds of dead organic matter, whether that's dung, whether it's fruit, apples, right, bread, animal cadavers, whether it's wood, or the dead cells under your toenails. Fungi can go and make a living out of that. So, yeah, it's amazing.
And that was an excerpt from a lecture by Kat Sweeney at the Bell Museum. which is basically the Natural History Museum of Minnesota, and I think has connections with the University of Minnesota. You can find that whole discussion from the Bell Museum by going to their YouTube channel, the Bell Museum YouTube channel. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Our next segment comes from Radio EcoShock, which we pretty regularly feature here on Equilibrium. Stuff from Radio EcoShock, which is broadcast by 105 radio stations in 5 different countries. And it comes out of Vancouver, BC on Co-op Radio and is basically hosted and produced by Alex Smith. So recently, Alex Smith sat down with J.B. McKinnon, who is the co-author of The 100-Mile Diet, to talk about his new book, which is called The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. So always interesting to hear interviews like this on Radio EcoShock. So here is Alex Smith interviewing J.B. McKinnon.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When the World Trade Towers fell, President George Bush advised Americans what to do. Go shopping. If we don't keep filling our lives with an endless parade of stuff, we all know what happens. Anarchy and famine. But the emissions, the waste, the pollution, we are shopping the planet to death and we know it. Can we ever escape these consumer lives? So a few years ago, I interviewed Canadian journalist J.B. McKinnon about his co-authored book, and that became a movement, The 100-Mile Diet, A Year of Local Eating. Now he's back with his latest book, The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. From Vancouver, Canada, James McKinnon, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be back here.
Well, of course, the whole world needs to keep making and buying stuff. We can't stop, except for a brief moment in time, we just did. James, what did we learn from the pandemic shutdowns?
I think we learned some extraordinary things. We learned that if we stop consuming at such a high rate, we get bluer skies. We get clearer stars in the night sky. We get a very abrupt and deep drop in carbon emissions. We start to see a resurgence in the vitality of the natural world. And we also saw some really dramatic changes in ourselves. We immediately started making sure that we had contact with our family and friends. We really saw what was vitally important to us during the pandemic. We started to pursue things like creative expression and personal excellence. And it was really dramatic how quickly all of that came about.
Well, those are things you cannot buy, obviously. I wonder, though, did online shopping grow to the same level as previous in-store shopping, or does going virtual result in somewhat less consumerism?
No, I mean, really, over the whole span of the pandemic, we saw people make a turn back towards consumerism. It's what we know best, and we reinvented it for the pandemic circumstances. So we did see, in fact, an increase in the sale of goods, for example. There was a steep decline in the purchase of services because we simply couldn't access those. We replaced that, I suppose, with the consumption of goods and with the consumption of watchables. We streamed more than we have ever streamed before online.
You know, we recently did a show about degrowth. You literally searched the world to find what a deconsumer society could look like. Why don't you give us the example that you found in Japan? And that's a country that's known for its shopping and luxury brands.
Yeah, what's happening in Japan right now is remarkable. They've really gone about 30 years without much growth to speak of. There's been brief periods of growth, but for the most part, their economy has been in something like a steady state. I ended up going to an island called Sado Island. It's a place that not only has seen degrowth, but has seen serious depopulation. So it's lost about half of its population. And that gives you a window into what would happen if we drew down consumption by a significant degree. And what you see there is simply the reinvention of society, not its collapse, but its reinvention. You see people turning towards more self-provisioning in their lives, often growing their own food or organizing daycare for their children, things like that, creating their own forms of entertainment. You saw a shift from big resort-style tourism to smaller-scale tourism, small-scale restaurants. To some people, it's heaven, and to some people, it's not what they're looking for. You know, they want the high excitement and the thrills of downtown Tokyo. The difference being that what's going on in Sato Island is profoundly sustainable, and what's happening in downtown Tokyo is not.
So if you had to choose maybe the top few most damaging things about this consumer economy, what would you tell people about?
Well, I would certainly say that climate change is powerfully driven by consumption. Carbon emissions track very closely with GDP, and the GDP, of course, is driven by consumerism. But, I mean, it really extends to everything. Consumerism pervades the way we eat. It pervades the effect we have on forests, on water. You name an environmental problem, and consumption is a powerful driver of that. But I would also say that some of the worst effects are upon ourselves. You know, we are driven more and more to be consumers rather than, for example, participants. As I took note in the book of the world's largest experiment in participatory culture just outside of London, England, it was really affecting to see what happens when people have an opportunity to participate in all kinds of activities in their daily lives that are beyond the earn and spend cycle, as compared to lives that are consumed by consumption.
So there are people, both in distant cultures, but right around here, looking for alternatives. And what sort of pathways can we find?
What I really concluded through this search around the globe for examples of glimpses, I suppose, of what post-consumer society might look like is that we need to build this. It's not a question of making changes so much in our personal lives. We've seen through history movements towards simpler living, towards decluttering, towards voluntary simplicity and downshifting. These things have come and gone, and it seems really difficult to have them stick and endure for very long within the framework of consumer society. What we can do is start to transform that society itself so that lower consumption is built into it. And then we get the benefits of a lower consuming society without each of us having to struggle through it as an individual choice.
We want to think that continuing disasters, and we do have them, will persuade people to wake up and change their consumer ways. But in the book, you quote retired anthropologist Richard Wilk, and he said this about consumerism: it thrives in situations of instability and contradiction, on social disruption and individual mobility as resource depletion ravages this planet. I wonder, are we going to soothe our troubles by shopping even more? Is shopping now a rebellious act?
It's a really counterintuitive idea, but materialism really kicks in when we feel like our material security is under threat. I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense. You want to have materialist values. You want to get out there and sort out how you're going to put food on the table and a roof over your head when you feel your material existence is actually threatened. You know, this points towards solutions like greater equality of opportunity in employment, greater equality in the distribution of income. These sorts of things that give more people more security are actually what can help us draw down consumption as well.
Your book took me to something that I have never understood reading the Wall Street Journal or any other financial media, and that is that there's going to be some people who are going to work hard and produce things on the other side of the world. And then here in the wealthy countries, our job is to buy things. And so 70% of our economy is consumerism. But really, that just sounds nuts. I mean, there's no God-given right for one part of the planet to work and the other part of the planet to get all the stuff. I don't see how that can continue. And I guess it's not continuing.
I agree. I mean, it's fundamentally unfair. I talked to the CEO of a manufacturing plant for clothing in Bangladesh, and I mean, he points out that, you know, it's not the Bangladeshis who are polluting their own nation or driving down wages or flooding cities through the effects of climate change. It's consumers elsewhere that are having those kinds of impacts, placing those kinds of pressures on Bangladeshi society. And it was really striking to me to, you know, to talk to him and hear that perspective, because maybe we've tried to convince ourselves that at best, you know, the people who are making the products that we use aren't making the link to our direct responsibility in Western society for these social and environmental consequences, but pretty clearly they are.
I think that's growing, and we're just going to see more of that. Getting closer to home, a friend of mine, he had to divorce his wife because her whole day consisted of going from one shop to another, buying things they didn't need and building up huge bills they really couldn't pay, and divorce ended up being the way out. I wonder if we'll need a new field of counseling for deprogramming shopaholics, or if you prefer, compulsive buying disorder.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think what's interesting about it is that the process of learning about consumption and how deeply ingrained it is actually made me more compassionate, I suppose, towards people's shopping habits, because it's a consumer society, it's a consumer economy, and there's these very powerful forces that compel us to consume. $600 billion advertising industry. We see right now government stimulus intended to get us back to the malls and buying things and taking flights, and, you know, the prices set by big businesses, the interest rates set by central banks. I mean, all of these things are designed to get us out there and spending. So, you know, it's not something where I really think there's a ton of value in making individual consumers feel terrible and guilty about doing exactly what so many powerful forces are driving them to do. I think it's really this question of starting to look at the system itself and how we can make changes in the system that will make it easier for all of us to consume less. Most people would agree that a lot of the consumption we do isn't providing much to our quality of life in the richer countries. They may feel, sparks of joy, as they say, from purchasing and repurchasing and buying more and more, but it's not accumulating into deep satisfaction or enduring happiness for very many people at this point.
So you bought a $50 broom.
I did. Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things with this was realizing that being thrifty isn't always the way to consume less. I think we kind of conflate those two things, but some people are thrifty and they buy enormous numbers of goods. So I started experimenting with this idea of, you know, buying fewer but better things, better quality things. And a $50 broom was one of those. And so I bought a handmade broom made by local artisans here in Vancouver, quite a bit more than a broom I might have bought at Walmart, but imbued with all kinds of values that are important to me. You know, I was able to hand my money over to people who, you know, I can pop by their store anytime and see them. It's repairable, and they're happy to do that for me. It's high quality. It sweeps like a dream, and it's very long-lasting. So, I mean, I'll have this broom for 20 years, perhaps, or more. So I started, you know, through this process, changing my own consumption habits. I still am interested in buying things secondhand and so on, but moving to this concept of buying fewer but better things allows us to surround ourselves. If we're going to have objects surrounding ourselves, then why not let them be beautiful products that are wonderful to use?
So when people get afraid of a crash, or actually experience one personally, what are the first items cut from spending, and what do most people see as truly indispensable, which I assume is apparently toilet paper?
So toilet paper is definitely a clear winner. It's actually really difficult to say. I mean, I looked at this for the United States in the Great Recession. There's a number of things that are pretty clear. People will stop buying new cars, basically big ticket items fall away pretty quickly because people don't want to gamble that much money. But beyond a certain point, people are very idiosyncratic. I mean, we're all individuals. We have very individual ways of consuming, and what's important to one person can be utterly insignificant to another. But what I do think is maybe more interesting in things like crashes is that you do see people move towards things that help them with self-provisioning. So gardening supplies, things that they use for cooking. You do see people acquiring different products that let them get out into the great outdoors, that let them get out and get healthy with their bodies, because often during the crash, a lot of us have more time to spend doing things for ourselves. And this, of course, is one of the, you know, the great lessons of a deconsumer society, is that we do trade off goods, services, and experiences to some extent, but what we get in exchange is a lot more free time that we can invest. And what people often invest that free time in is relationships, particularly relationships with friends and family and even strangers, but also in relationships with the natural world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is journalist and author J.B. McKinnon. We are talking about his latest book, The Day the World Stopped Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. I did not know that Finland experienced a pretty severe fall during the early 1990s. How did people adapt to that?
Finland was an unusual situation because they have a really unified culture, and they also have, you know, quite a strongly social democratic government structure. So they taxed the wealthy, they distributed wealth. Maybe more than anything else, what you saw in Finland was a certain amount of relief from the direction that things had been going. So at the time that the Great Finnish Depression struck in the 1990s, Finland had just gone through the same kind of boom as a lot of places in the West saw in the 80s. They had yuppie culture, they had the greed is good mentality starting to build in Finland, and that was historically brand new in that country. It had been, you know, really strongly social democratic country up to that point. The 1990s saw relief from that and a return to a sense of greater equality between individual Finns. They weathered the storm without, as people pointed out, without riots, without mass protests. They buckled down, shared what they had to some extent and through the government, and they got through it.
Kind of reminds me of what people did in Iceland, too. On another topic, talk to us about the links between shopping and the night sky. I never considered this until I read your book.
Yeah, this is one of the quirkier aspects. When I started looking into, well, what happens if we suddenly stop consuming so much, one of the things that came out of the research was that the world starts to get dimmer. So I had not realized that there's a fairly fixed percentage. I can't recall exactly what it is right now, but there's a fairly fixed percentage of the GDP of any nation that gets spent on lighting. So when degrowth occurs, the overall brightness of a society actually starts to dim. That can be quite beneficial. I mean, we have quite a few problems with light pollution, and of course, lights burn energy. So it raised that question, you know, would we be comfortable living in a somewhat darker world? Is that the kind of shift in consumption that we would be able to welcome? And I think the upside, of course, is that you do end up with wonderful night skies. You end up with much less light pollution. And the only real downside seems to be that we're anxious about adapting to a little bit more darkness. But there's great variety in the cities around the world in terms of how bright or how dim they are. And so I visited Berlin, which is one of the dimmer of the large cities. And I thought it was a wonderful place to visit at night. People sitting in darkened parks, dimmer streets than we see in a lot of cities around the world. Personally, I found it soothing and pleasant, and it was wonderful to be able to stand in the middle of a big city and see, you know, two or three times more stars than I do here in Vancouver.
Are you aware of the Reverend Billy Talon and the Church of Stop Shopping?
You bet I am, yeah.
Well, he's kind of a hero, but I think that in some of his actions, I mean, at one point he was standing in a mall with a bullhorn telling people to stop shopping as sort of a religious sermon, and he was arrested and taken away in handcuffs. So I started thinking about all the ways that the big system that you just described earlier will coerce us and fight off any anti-consumerism, trying to suppress it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, it really is part of the reason that I started working on this book is because as a topic, consumption and consumerism had really fallen by the wayside. I mean, I really hadn't seen it at the center of discussions around sustainability since the 1990s. And that didn't make any sense to me, given that consumption is not only now the biggest driver of environmental crises, but it's getting worse all the time. You know, some of the conversations I had as I tried to reach out to larger corporations and see how they respond to the idea that maybe they should be addressing sustainability by simply encouraging people to reduce their consumption. And some of those conversations became almost cloak and dagger. I mean, within the larger corporations of the world, they really do not want to talk about this subject. And it was a frightening topic for some people to approach, to the extent that they, you know, many people were either unwilling to talk to me or certainly not willing to talk to me on the record. But at the same time, I did find, you know, a lot of people are thinking about these things and a lot of people are recognizing the nature of this problem. We need to break it up back out into the open and put it at the center of our conversations again.
And meanwhile, the web seems to work against us. If I look at a bird bath and decide, well, I don't need a bird bath, so I'm not going to buy one of those, I get hunted for days, maybe weeks, by little pictures of bird baths everywhere I go. How can we change that? Should we be going to Facebook and to Twitter and Instagram and say, you have a part to play in the wrecking of the world. Are you going to change the rule somewhat?
These are the kinds of issues that we should be looking at, right? We should be able to opt out of these sorts of things. And if it means that we need to move towards models that are advertising free, and that means that we have to pay more for the information that we access, then, you know, that's part of the discussion. But we certainly should be able to opt out of advertising that targets us in the way you described so well. You know, these bird baths and pairs of pants and skis and things like this that pursue us through the internet, those are directly trying to overcome what is supposed to be a good consumer habit, which is you feel that impulse to buy something and you give yourself a little time to see whether or not you really, really want to buy it. That's the kind of impulse that helps us draw down consumption. And here we have big business and big tech specifically targeting that weakness and trying to break it down. So it is exactly the kind of thing that we want to look at regulating in some way.
Well, we learn a ton by looking at what would happen the day the world stopped shopping. It's hard to imagine that it will happen anytime soon. Maybe it will take decades. Maybe we need a time for withdrawal, or maybe we will have a revolution when people finally figure out what's killing the planet. What are your thoughts? How is this going to go forward?
Yeah, I mean, the day the world stops shopping is a thought experiment in my book, right? In order to sort of see how we can get past this dilemma we're in, where we need to stop shopping for the sake of the planet, and yet we seem to have to keep shopping for the sake of the economy, I wanted to try this thought experiment where we just, you know, I just on the page make stopping shop and see how it plays out over the coming days, weeks, decades, even centuries. And the way to think about it is not that we're aiming for some kind of moment when we all put our wallets away and never buy another unnecessary thing again, but rather that we start to think about a gradual change in the system towards a system that encourages more durable products and repairable products, that builds the true cost of social and environmental injuries into the prices of the products that we buy in the same manner that carbon taxes are starting to do today. We can change our cities so that there's more things that we can do in the cities that are not consumptive. We can draw down inequality, because inequality is a big driver of consumption. So I think we're looking at more of, it can start tomorrow, but it will play out over years in the same way that the green technology or the digital technology revolutions played out. We didn't expect those things to happen overnight, and a shift to a deconsumer society doesn't happen overnight either. It's work at every level and in every corner of society and culture.
I mentioned you were a journalist. I find your work all over the place. You also teach writing at the University of British Columbia. I'm interested in your process. It seems like it's a personal one. Your 100-mile diet was certainly personal. This book sounds pretty personal, the way you approached it. Is it organic? Do you know what the next thing that's going to bubble out of you will be? Are you working on something now?
I'm always working on something. I mean, at this point, I've shifted back to working on some magazine-length pieces. But I usually have a bunch of book ideas tucked away in my in my head. And when I finish one project, I kind of reach inside and look for one that I think is going to fascinate me and engage me at the level that it really has to write a book, because it's a long process putting these things together. And this one was especially gratifying, I think, because I wasn't sure that there was a lot new to say about consumption. I mean, we've had people throughout history saying we need to consume less, we need to be less materialist, you know, we need to shop less. I wasn't totally sure that there would be something new to say about it. But when I went out and really looked at, well, what might be involved in creating a lower consuming world, then I found all these interesting people and exciting case studies from history and really great stories to tell that illuminate what could be the path towards that deconsumer society.
Yes, you just got me thinking about a lot of history. There have been the Christian sects who renounced materialism and lived with less, and of course in Asian cultures, in the Hindu religions, we find people who are doing that, some in Buddhism. There's been a struggle to try and rearrange ourselves according to the physical world that we live in. I think your book is part of that. It's part of self-discovery in a big way.
I think so. I mean, I think what people who read this book will—I think they'll be entertained. I mean, the thought experiment was fun to do. It was fun to take the world and make the shopping stop and see what plays out. That was an enjoyable experience. But what comes out of it are these deeper themes of change at every level, from the kind of choice we make when we set out to buy a product that we need, to the way we orient our values and what priorities we put at the center of our lives. And, you know, it was really fascinating encountering, for example, people in Namibia whose cultural practice for literally tens of thousands of years has been to live with very, very few possessions, and to, you know, to meet and speak with those people and get a sense of, well, I'm really just to observe how deeply satisfying their lives appear to be. I mean, certainly as satisfying and as rich and fulfilling as our lives, and I think in some ways more so.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
And that was an interview done by Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock with J.B. McKinnon, the author of The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. He is also the co-author of the older book, The 100-Mile Diet. If you want to find out more about Radio EcoShock, you can go to ecoshock.org and listen to other interviews like that one. So thanks for listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're basically out of time. We're going to leave you with a bit of music, and we'll also let you know that you can always email us at ecolibrium@ckut.ca. And you can follow us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/EcoLibriumCKUT Montreal. And we also have a podcast version of the show. We don't put up everything that we do on the show on the podcast, but you can find it in Spotify by looking for the EcoLibrium Radio podcast. So we're going to leave you with a tune that has an environmental theme, and that's Fly Eagle Fly, which came out, I think, in around 1974. And it was on an album by the Marshall Tucker Band. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Marshall Tucker Band, but this is their tune, Fly, Eagle, Fly.
One, two, three, play. I can't imagine
how the world would be. About to see the gray squirrel climbing in an old tree. To walk through a cornfield and not see the wild duck fly. Yeah. I believe before the world ever got that bad, I'd be on my knees and crying. Won't you fly, oh eagle fly? You better run, little cottontail, run. I hope you both will live long enough to see the setting sun. Black bear got no key. And that a bull alligator is just about soon as bitter day. Won't you fly, oh eagle fly? You better run. Up in the sky, and I could see the wild geese fly. And on a warm spring day, I could look up in the air, and I could see the yellow butterfly. How long has it been since you heard the tiny flutter of the little wing of a hummingbird? And I once saw the picture of a buffalo a thousand in the herd. Won't you fly? Mr. Eagle fly, you better run, little cottontail, run.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
In Quebec, vaccination against COVID-19 is underway, but not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow up.
I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.